Hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini with Go See Talk. Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast. We have an experience like none other for you today. We are speaking to a fantastically seasoned, proficient, talented composer extraordinaire, Andrew Kaczynski. The most amazing thing you've probably heard about his name attached to recently was Gran Turismo, based on a true story. Whether it has the semicolon or not, it's still a badass movie. The music lifts your spirits, so does the movie, as you follow Yan from sim racing to championships. I'm going to quit rambling. I do that. Sorry, it's just who I am. Andrew, thank you so much for being on the podcast. How are things in your world?
Well, thank you so much, Mark, for having me. I really appreciate it. Yeah, life is good. You know, it's been some time since Gran Turismo was released, and it was nice to get good response. It was nice to see that it's been popular on Netflix. It's been getting a lot of plays, getting my music out there. So yeah, it's been very exciting. But I think I probably had around 3 weeks off afterwards, and then I was right back.
Okay. So a very, very small victory laps, and then just on to the next challenge.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I went to Hawaii for the first time. I spent about a week in Hawaii, and that was very much needed, but then it was right back to reality very, very quickly.
Okay. Well, you know, I have to say up front, sometimes when I'm speaking to composers about a project, it's like the week of the release and there's a flurry up to it. And I absolutely love the fact that you, Lauren, the cinema goers have been able to live with this, let it breathe, let it mature, like wine. So how, it hadn't quite been a year yet, but how have things been after, like, okay, I'm press circuit's done, I'm feeling like I can actually appreciate this better. How has it sat with you?
It's sat pretty well, actually. It's my life was pretty crazy leading up to that release, because you know, we didn't really have a lot of time to work on it. We kind of came in, probably had around 2 to 3 months to finish the whole score. It was 18-hour days, locked in the room, not going anywhere. And then the week after I finished, I got a call from Hans Zimmer, and he was like, hey, we're working on Dune 2 right now, because I worked on the first Dune. And he's like, you know, we're just wrapping up. There's a, you know, few things that may be needed. Would you be willing to come out to a studio in LA? I still have a studio there, but I have another studio somewhere else. And I was like, yeah, of course. So finished Gran Turismo. Week later, I was right back in it on another film. I had just got off a flight and then went straight to Warner Brothers and watched like the latest cut and everything. So I didn't really have of that time to process, appreciate, think about, and then also there was the strike going on. There was the actor strike. So, you know, the premiere, it was just a casting. It was just a crew. You know, there was no actors there. There's no writers. But it was nice to meet with Neil, because you know we were. He was in Canada for a lot of the project. I was in LA. Lauren was in London. It was just kind of, we were all scattered all over the place. And that was the first time that I was able to see Neil in person and talk with him about the score and everything. I don't believe it really has been kind of your normal release. And you know, there was a lot of external factors and stuff. But yeah, after, you know, I formed a lot of really great new connections. And it, you know, it was so great working with Lauren's team over at 14th Street Music. All of his additional arrangers and composers, sound designers there, and then also the musicians. You know, we had Matt Chad Smith from the Red Hot Chili Peppers come in and do a session. We had incredible vocalists, you know, it's just been nice to keep in touch with everyone and form these new connections. And you know, I've been working on new films, and it's nice to have all these people in my arsenal that I can go to and be like, hey, you know, how are you feeling about this? And you know, it's so funny, because I you know, after all these years of working in the industry, because I've been here for around 15 years, when I started off, I was so scared of vocals. I had no idea what to do to vocals. It was just that thing, that myth that I didn't necessarily want to get close to. And then over time, I you know, and it really was Hans, you know, working on projects like Dune, working with incredible vocalists like Laura Kotler, and many, many more, I started to see that the voice is actually a beautiful, beautiful thing. And I feel that it really does have a place in film music. You know, I really want to connect with people with my scores. I want to connect with the source music. I want everything to be a bit more fluid and for the score to have a bit of a modern touch, and without having to do a full-on EDM song or what have you. And vocals are just that, it's that incredible bridge to try and connect everything. So, you know, a couple months ago, I started working on this indie art film. My close friend Reza Ghassemi is directing it. And it's just like indie art detective film, very, very strange. And I was like, let's do it all with vocals. Let's do it all with vocals. I started writing with orchestra, started writing my suites, my themes, motifs, everything. And then, you know, I connected with a few of the vocalists I had been working with, and we were starting to actually form a bit of a vocabulary, something that's a bit new, something that's a bit fresh, kind of taking, you know, classical Max Richter, Johan Johansson type style music. Well, I mean, Johan used so much vocals, but doing that kind of chamber music, but with more like vocal centric and everything. So yeah, I think the biggest, I know it's been an incredibly long answer to your question, but the biggest thing is relationships, continuing relationships, and checking in with people, talking people, because I mean, that's what this industry is all about. It's all about the teams. It's all about, you know, the people that come together to finish these films, because hundreds and hundreds of people go into each stage of filmmaking, from pre-production to production to post-production. And it's nice to have those relationships flourish, because you never know what might come next.
Oh, 1,000%. You know, I think that looking at your portfolio, you see some usual suspects, I would say. Wonder Woman, Dune, like you said, Hans. That also translates into Lauren Balfe, John Powell, Tina Guo, people who are, you know, like they kind of like a beehive. They kind of circulate around the nebulous or whatever. So the funny thing is, like, Stephanie Ikonomu was Harry Gregson-Williams' assistant, and now she's kind of like on her own. And like, even if all you did was deliver pizza to the soundstage, just having those titles on your resume, it's like, this guy was amongst the best of the best, probably learning a whole lot, had a whole lot just to get in the door. And then now you're like, hey, I'm here. Like, you're like Jan Martinborough. I'm here. I'm arrived. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, you never know what might come of things. You know, I'm so happy for all of Stephanie Economy's success, and everyone else, from Dave Fleming to Steve Mazzaro, countless people that have come and started working with these big composers and then, you know, went off on their own and everything. And, you know, I started my career at Hans Zimmer Studio. I was an intern for about 4 months. I went to Los Angeles Recording School, which was like a recording engineer school, but I only really went there to learn how to write music on computers. And I went to the guidance counselor, and because they have an internship program, they find you internship at studios and everything like that. And he's like, well, you know, I have this internship at Hans Zimmer's studio. And I was like, who's that? I had no idea who Hans was. I had no idea what film music was. You know, it was that thing when I was younger, and you know, I was watching a movie and I see the credits come up and says music by, and I was like, oh, that's not the band of this song right now. Like, who's that? I was so green, and because I started with Hans when I was 19, and when I was younger, I was in punk bands and hardcore bands. I was screaming my head off, playing guitar at anyone who would listen to me. And so when when I had that meeting with my guidance counselor, started to think about it. I started to Google him and research everything he's done. I was like, oh my gosh, I love the score to Pirates of the Caribbean. And I love the Kraken theme. Like, that is so badass. Gladiator is one of my favorite movies. And so yeah, I passed up a paid opportunity because I had interviewed with a post-production house editing audio or editing dialogue and sound effects for TV shows, and they were willing to pay me $12 an hour. And I passed on that because I went to my parents and I was like, what should I do? And they're like, go with this guy Hans Zimmer. Like, it seems like he has an incredible production there, and he did. So I sacrificed the pay for a non-paying internship, worked my ass off. I was there, 7 days a week. I got there and I just kind of fully immersed myself within the community and just really like try to act like a sponge and pick up all the information the other people were giving me. And people just kept saying, this is your life, this has to become your life. And I was like, okay, I'm here, I'm ready. And so yeah, my actual like first technical job or working with closely with a composer was Lorne Balfe. Way back in the day, he was an additional writer for Hans, and so I was hired on as his technical assistant. And I was also his personal assistant, and then that grew into doing sound design, making synth sounds from him, and then composing, doing additional writing and everything like that. And I have so much to thank with Lorne. With everything that he's given me from the very start, because he is the one who recommended me to Hans that I should be an additional writer for Hans. And then I started working for Hans, started working ad as additional with him, really working on sound design. And then, as time went on, started to get my own projects, started to venture out. But I never wanted to get rid of those connections because I respect them so much. I respect their musical capabilities, who they are as people. They're incredibly lovely people. So I went off, would work on my own, and then I'd come back, work on one of their projects, and then I'd leave. And just it's nice to never burn bridges. And not that I could ever burn bridges with them. Like, I very much enjoy working with them. And then yeah, it's just that's where my whole community started. And because the film music community can be rather small in Los Angeles, now things are a little bit different with Zoom and incredibly fast internet speeds. People can live wherever they want in the world and still work with people in Los Angeles. So yeah, one thing I always try to do in my career is just try and connect with as many people as possibly can, because that's what film music is all about. We're just trying to get people to connect with the story. And I'm a storyteller first, a musician second. Like, I want to supplement the film. I want to supplement the director's vision. I want to supplement the actor's performance, and anything that I can do to help support that, I want to. And it goes right into our community, and maintaining all these connections and keeping these relationships, because you never know what they might turn into or what could happen later on.
I can't tell you how much there is to unpack in all that, starting with a guidance counselor who, like lead sheets, actually had in a drawer, there's an internship with Hansa. I'm surprised that was even an option. Like, those are probably snatched up. But like, perception, I think, is reality sometimes. For as fast as film music has to work to deliver on time, I imagine that you go in and it's like Blue Man Group all the time. Just it does. Are there what's the downtime? Is it like The Office where it's like ring, ring, click, click, click?
Yeah, my downtime is serious binge watching on Netflix, communicating, just going out into the kitchen talking with people. And there's not very many outdoor activities. You're kind of just stuck within a room. But in recent years, like I found that I need to get outside. I need to get in nature. And then that is what actually inspires me, and it gets me to clear my head. And, you know, I'll just go out of the studio if I'm stuck or if I don't know what to do, and I'll just walk. I'll walk for 4 or 5 miles, and I'll have ideas that come in, and then I can have that time to sift through them and realize, okay, that's a bad idea, or no, that's going to take way too long. There's no need to do that. But yeah, I think that the main thing about working in film music with me personally is that music was my hobby. Music was my passion. Music was my love, you know, and I find so much interest in it. So, yes, there were a few years where I did lose a bit of that love. You know, it became more of a job for me. I wasn't listening to new music. I was just listening to a lot of podcasts. Just trying to, you know, give myself a break, because that's the tough part, is eventually you burn out. So having your hobby be your job, it can get to be a bit overkill sometimes. But now, the past few years, like, I'm listening to music again. I love synths. I have such a passion for synths, and they can be rather complicated at times and take a while to read the manual and figure out how to get them working. And so that's kind of what I do on my downtime. And I also just listening to Spotify, you know, just listening through Beatles songs, listening for chord changes, you know, just listening through Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd. Like, well, what do they do there? What do they do there? And it's just because it's always an interest to me. And then, you know, also going back into my classical music repertoire, you know, just expanding, because there's so much music out there that no one person can possibly listen to every piece of music that has ever been written. It would take thousands of years. So I'm just trying to grasp as much knowledge, as much info as I could possibly get.
What about punk still speaks to you? What are you able to, you know, are you waiting for that moment to just drop something like Goldfinger or Offspring, and like just some, you know, wild guitars or something like that on your next score, or just throw it in, like maybe it's backwards or manipulated or something, like anything like that?
No, absolutely. I mean, I still kind of do that to this day. Like, I'll you know, I was a big hardcore guy back in the day, and so a lot of kind of like Every Time I Die and Throw Down and all these like really mosh pit heavy music, and they use a lot of double bass kick pedals. I'll kind of like remember those little breakdowns, and then I'll put it into a sequencer pattern. So you get this, blah, 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 blah. There's so many different ways of incorporating into it. And I do a lot of it without even knowing. There's been a couple times where I'm writing a song, or I'm doing an action track, and I was like, hold on a minute. Is that a Taking Back Sunday chord progression? I was like, so I have to sit there for a second and be like, oh no, you can't do that. That's cute without the E. I think, you know, since I spent so much time listening to that music as a kid, it kind of seeps through in some of my songwriting. And then there's projects where you get that opportunity to do that. You know, I just finished working on this project that, you know, unfortunately I can't really talk about yet. But it was with a video game company. And I was able to just rock out, and I was able to, you know, get out the guitar, get out the bass, and listen to some AC/DC, some Metallica, some Led Zeppelin, and I was just able to do it. And then it was, you know, how do I make it more film? You know, adding more synths to the melody to beefing it up a bit, getting the bass really, really nice and solid with a a lot of nice synth subs, and yeah, so I you get those opportunities where you can just do it. You can be that 12-year-old kid, you know, listening to your favorite rock album, and you're able to do it in real life. And you know, we were able to, you know, actually just 2 or 3 days ago, we had a session in Nashville with some incredible musicians. And that was my first session in Nashville. I've always wanted to record there. I've always wanted to go there, and I still will hopefully someday. Because I just hear stories of the musicianship, just how they're able to play the guitar, how they're able to play the drums. And it was just an absolutely incredible experience. So yeah, hopefully sometime soon in the near future, I can talk about it, because it was such an incredibly fun project.
That's really amazing. We'll wait for that opportunity. But you mentioned 12-year-old Andrew. So what was 12-year-old Andrew doing? Was he video games? Was he running through the woods with his friends? Was he, you know, was he stealing his cousin's Motley Crue records? Because that's what I did when I was 12. Like I got tapes of Motley Crue, and I knew I shouldn't have listened to it, but still badass.
Yeah. All right. Well, here's your first curveball, Mark. Yeah. When I was younger, I played hockey. I started playing hockey when I was about 5 years old. That was my first passion. You know, I kind of played 6, 7 days a week. I eventually went up to Washington and BC, Canada to play. It was very much my life for quite a period of time. And so I think that that's where, you know, my passion for rock music came from. You know, like going to the games, my dad be like, you have to get pumped up. You have to feel it. You have to get the energy. And so, yeah, that's where a lot of those like Pennywise bro hymns and Power Man 5000 and Rob Zombie.
Power Man, Limp I Bizkit. Remember that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually just listened to that song when Worlds Collide like a few days ago, and I was like, oh my gosh, I used to play that all the time when I was going to games. But yeah, and you know, my dad got me into music at a very young age. He gave me my first guitar when I was 8, bought me my first CD when I was CD player and CDs when I was 9. We would just go to Best Buy and buy as many CDs as we could. And you know, my passion for music started at a very young age. But when I was playing hockey when I was 6, 17, I was playing up in Spokane, Washington, and I had a really bad injury. So I was skating down the ice. Another guy came over, he stuck his knee out, hit my knee, my leg went all the way around. Pulled my groin, pulled my hip flexor. It was kind of a season-ending injury. That was the time where I really started to, you know, play the guitar in earnest. You know, I couldn't leave my bed for a few months. And I would just jam out on it continuously, all day, every day. And I think that was the period of time where I realized, I was like, I think I want to do something with music. I think I want to have a life in music. And, you know, cause I am the first in my family to work, with music professionally. So it was a bit scary, but yeah, that was kind of the turning point where I was like, you know what, let me see if I could pursue this as a career.
Well, you know, even if you had the musical backing in your family, it's not always, you would not always get the support. I know John Powell's dad told him famously, you'd make a better plumber than a musician. So, but he's got all good things.
Those pipes would be able to sing.
Turn a P trap into an S trumpet and looks like a tuba. No,
yeah.
It'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, let's jump into Gran Turismo, because this is something, I mean, this is not hyperbole, this is not praise for the sake of it. This is my Star Wars. I mean, I kid you not. There's something I cannot stop listening to it, cannot stop thinking about it. There's so many elements that I love, and, you know, starting with the "and we're off," it, you know, like, it sounds like the chorus, or like the people in the stands are like, it's like you're watching a football game, like a, you know, in a European football game. And there's, you know, like just short of having vuvuzelas in there, you've got some screeching tires, you've got crazy drums, My favorite track of all is I Will Be Your Judge. I don't know where to start, except what the hell did you do? Like, what was your brief on this in those 3 weeks that you were like, holy shit, we need this now, from now to then, and I gotta do all this? Like,
yeah. Well, you know, it really comes down to Neil Blomkamp, the director. You know, he had this vision, and he really was the driving force behind all of this. And, you know, because when we came in, a lot of the music that was in the temp was just songs. And, you know, they were, you know, big songs that you couldn't get. and we could see that he wanted this to have a fresh soundtrack. They wanted this to be a soundtrack that kids could listen to, and not just it be overly film music, just like big bombastic orchestral music. He wanted to bridge that gap. And so, yeah, when I first started, when Lauren called me in, I took about 3 weeks just making synth sounds and trying to make synth sounds that sounded like car screeches, brakes, you know, turns. I would go on to YouTube and listen to, you know, hours of F1 races, streetcar races. Like, what are the different sounds? What can I take from here? I even spoke to my partner's stepfather. I was like, how does a transmission work? Like, I was trying to figure out how cars worked at a fundamental level, because then I could incorporate that into, you know, motors, into ostinatos and everything like that. And, you know, because there was this one ostinato in a track, The Drive Within, that we used at multiple points within the film. And pretty much what it is it's two ostinatos playing at two different tempos. And so every kind of four bars, they lock up and they sound like they're in time. But then over the next four bars, they kind of drift. And so I was trying to think of just thinking of changing gears, changing transmission, and how can we apply that to music? Just so we could have some kind of subliminal intent behind the music, that it wasn't just another synth score, that it wasn't just another, you know, drum rhythm, that, you know, these things actually were thought about. We tried to take a new approach to things. Because that, you know, that was something that Hans instilled in me and everyone that has ever worked with him. You know, he's like, you know, because this is what he says, but I, you know, he says that his sound is what sets him apart from everyone else, because he spends so much time sampling, recording live musicians, getting instruments so that he could play and create the score. And I know that a lot of people will do that. They'll look at the film and see, you know, what aspects of this can we take. And, you know, the sound design was so incredible in this film, and we knew that we didn't want to fight that. So we didn't want to just use real car sounds, car brakes, metal clangs, or anything like that. We wanted to recreate them with synthesizers. So it still kind of sounds organic, but it won't battle the actual sound design. And we can actually work in a bit more of a harmonious way and not just fight each other. Because I know most composers and sound designers will admit that when it comes down to the dub, there is that battle between music and sound. And if you can work on it together to where you take out your own part of the frequency spectrum, then you're never going to fight with each other.
Well, let's go a little deeper into that. You know, what I was saying that I thought I heard was tire screeching was actually sampled synthesizer to, you know, to. So did you create something that was maybe a pitch below so it didn't sound like a BF Goodrich rubber, or like how, like what was done to get it close to an actual element but still be completely electronic?
Well, okay, so yeah, kind of what my trick is I'll bring in sound effects into my sequencer, and I'll just listen to it over and over and over again, and I won't start with any sounds, like any real sounds. I'll only start with oscillators and, you know, stuff from a synth. And then I'll either use granulizers or MSEGs or different filters, different ADSRs, envelopes to get the sound, to try and emulate it as much as possible. So, I mean, every case is different. There's no one trick to, you know, do this replication. And I know that I'm not the best at it. You know, there's a lot of people out there that will make synth sounds, that like, it sounds like a live cello or sounds like a real voice. And with technology nowadays, with the amount of programs and hardware that's coming out, things are endless. And honestly, when musicians figure out how to get AI to work for us in a non-competitive way, but in a harmonious way, I can't even imagine what could be possible. You know, you could have sampled instruments that sound exactly like the real thing. You can maybe get a guitar sound that sounds exactly like B.B. King. So I don't know, the possibilities are endless, but with what we have today, there's so many plugins, so many different avenues of exploring this. But usually what happens in the most original way is when you start with something really simple, you start with just one synth and you work within the limitations of that. And a lot of the times you know, it's a series of, oh, that's a cool sound. Oh, that actually works. And then a lot of the time by the end of it, I won't have something that perfectly emulates that original sound that I was trying to replicate, but I'll have a new sound where I'm like, ah, that's it. And, you know, I forget which track it is on the album. I'm so bad with track names on albums because we work to different names during the project and we just change the names at the very last moment so we don't remember it. But yeah, there's this one sequence in the film where Jan is he's racing to the arcade for his like qualifying race to get into the academy. There, I wanted to replicate the sound of like the start of a race, you know, that ba ba ba. I was like, let me do it with synths. Let me see what new ways, and then I can do it. And then I did like a lot of prepared pianos, printed a lot of different pianos in different ways, and then used kind of denoisers to take out the sound of the note. So you're just kind of left with the artifacts of everything. So I could leave that behind the synth sound, which was delivering the tone, and it created kind of a bit more of a organic atmosphere, because you're working with things that aren't very well, they're real in their own sense, but they can sound very digital very quickly. So it's how do you then take organic instruments to help support it a bit.
Well, when it comes to the world of synths, is everything exploratory? I mean, I imagine with, you know, the guitar behind you, you know what an F sharp major is in the bar, you know how to pluck and play a blues scale, but is with something that you actually can't put your hands to, is everything like making it up every moment, every step of the way?
Pretty much, yeah. You know, the thing about synthesis is that you have to create a new instrument every single time. And, you know, you're a lot of the times you're creating something that no one has created before. And a lot of times, a lot of people use presets. I use presets. So I'm not going to sit here and say that I'm a snob and I don't use presets. Yes, I definitely do use presets, but then it's taking time afterwards to treat it, to work on it, to make it sound a bit more original, make it sound a bit better. And I think it really is synthesis, good synthesis. It's all about quality control. It's all about knowing when, like, just you keep telling yourself it's not good enough, it can be better, and it's just It's knowing the right time to say, okay, it's done. Because that's usually the most difficult thing. You could work on it. You could explore it for months on end, do all these different things. And then you may get to the end of it and realize that, oh, my work on day two, that was actually the best. And so I think it's all about knowing when to stop and knowing that when you're happy with something. And I think that that's probably the toughest part, because you can't teach that to anyone. And I know that I still make that mistake at times where, yeah. And it's another thing that you'll be working on it for 6 hours and you'll tell yourself, well, I don't want to waste all this time. I don't want to have wasted 6 hours on this thing. But yeah, a lot of the times you just have to throw it in the bin and move on.
Well, comparable to say tennis, you know, like if you're just practicing your swing at a tennis ball machine, you know, you're just going to get good at one thing and then you really get the back and forth with another player. So how did you lean on Lorne and vice versa to sort of push this over the finish line, or, you know, finish first in racing terms?
Yeah, I mean, it's honestly such a team effort, and the fact that there's so much to do. And a lot of the times it's just, you know, focusing on your strengths, focusing on what you're good at, and but then just continuing to communicate. You know, I sent music to Lorne probably every single day. He would send me stuff. We would send voice notes of like, well, have you tried this on the piano? Like, he would send me piano maps and be like, well, I think the tune could do this there. And it was, you know, it was a very collaborative effort, where we definitely worked on each other. And then, you know, another thing is, you know, Lorne is very close with the video game community. He does a lot of, he has done the video game awards for quite a few years now. And he brought in a bunch of incredible video game composers, just to try and bring that video game sound to the score. So we sent them a few suites, and they would just make a bunch of sounds. And it was really interesting to go through all of these additions and see what could work and what was the best possible combination of everything. And yeah, you know, Lorne is one of the busiest composers in Hollywood. He's works on so many different things at the same time. And so, yeah, we really just tried to value the time that we did have him there. And yeah, I mean, since we were in different places all over the world, it was very sparse. You know, it was kind of a text message here, email there. We were just communicating whatever we could. And I know that on Hans's films, you know, he likes everyone in the same room. And so there'd be a lot of jam sessions. There would be a lot of times where we'd all get our instruments, go into his room and just riff on things, see what could happen, see where a good idea could come from. Because I think that that's the thing. A lot of these good ideas, you know, they kind of come out of nowhere. They kind of come from just someone riffing in the background, and then, you know, the producer sends in Hans of identifying it and saying, oh, that's our hook, and then taking that and then building a song around that. And yeah, I think we had a similar thing on Gran Turismo, where I wrote a few suites, Lorne wrote a few suites. And then, you know, I was like, well, what if I took my chord structure and his tune and put them together? I think that that could actually work. Like, what if I took Jan's family theme and put it together with the Gran Turismo theme, the And We're Off theme? And how do we make like a happy marriage between these two things? And a lot of the times that's how new ideas are formed and new themes and everything.
Well, that's amazing that it worked, because I could just imagine the jam session that's happening. Like you said, people riffing off of each other to develop something new. But I also love the fact that taking things that you probably didn't think could have worked, like you said, your chord progression with his elements and make something magical. I can't tell you how much I love this, but there's an emotion to it that is so strong. I'm actually kind of curious about the last, the end of the movie, where you would probably expect to get the Andrew and Lauren special, but you get a Moby song. What was the discussion about, obviously placement is important. The director dictates that and, it kind of is what it is. I love that song, by the way, but I'm just curious, like, why that was a source music choice as opposed to more score. Can you go back to maybe that discussion?
Yeah. So, that Moby track, that was a Neil placement. He placed that very early on in the cut, and it had been there for quite a while, and it was kind of loved by everyone. Because we did do a couple of versions where we could do Jan's theme in full and everything, but there was something about the Moby song that really kind of connected us with Jan at that moment, and we didn't want to sit there and just rip off the song or just do something similar, because it is fairly simplistic. But I mean, that's the thing with Moby. He has such a incredible taste and incredible style when it comes to his music. We felt that it really connected us with Jan's journey at that moment, and it was that song was loved by everyone. It was loved by the studio, producers, screenings. It was a moment that, even people, when they saw it in screenings, they made a moment of it, or they made note of it. I think sometimes you just have to accept that, a song can absolutely take precedence with people's emotions and how they're feeling. I got moved from it when I heard it in there.
And it also, I'm sure I'm projecting this, but it almost takes it back to like a timestamp, because it's a 90s era song from Moby, and it's almost around the same time when Gran Turismo started to become a thing. So in a way, it sort of kind of calls back to like how this all started. I'm probably making it up, but I also love the this type of racing is a world sport. So the entire score has a worldly feel to it from, as I said, the chanting from the stadium. But there's also something beautiful too, because it does walk that line, because it's juxtaposing sim racers to real racers, and you've got real instruments, you've got synth instruments, but as you were telling me, it's pretty much more on the synthetic side. So it's trying to champion the fact that Jan pushed through and got to where he was because of the electronic training that he had. So I always dig too deep into this and become a nerd.
That's an incredible point. And I think there's a lot of validity in Gran Turismo is such a huge community, and it's been around for so many years. It was on the original PlayStation. So many people love playing that game. And we wanted to play homage to it in certain places. And when Jan does qualify for the Academy, Neil wanted to have the original Gran Turismo theme in there from the first game. And that was like our little secret egg in there, just kind of putting that in there for all of the fans.
That's great. Well, it's funny when you mentioned the lights and the sounds when a race starts, the beep, beep. I immediately thought of Mario Kart on the Super Nintendo. That's my connection to racing. It's such a weird I am. You mentioned music, you mentioned songs, you mentioned hockey. I have to ask, are you a fan of Shorzy? Have you heard of Letterkenny or Shorzy?
Letterkenny. Yes, I have heard of Letterkenny. I haven't heard of Shorzy.
Okay. So Shorzy is a faceless hockey player in a couple episodes, a number of episodes of Letterkenny. He got his own
Oh.
spin-off show. And I think the strength of the show is the music selection. So Jared Kiso created the show. I'm saying his name right, but they have a fantastic music supervision group. And most of it's stuff that Jared listens to on his phone and says, hey, can you get the license to this? So anyway, I was saying, if you haven't seen Shoresy and you have Hulu, you might want to check it out, because there's some badass songs in there. There's Subtract, there's other, you know, music I've never heard of, but it's always like everyone picks up your ears. Hadouken is another one. It's just amazing stuff. So if you, you know, sounds like you don't have a lot of free time, but if you do, it might perk your ears up a little bit.
No, I'll definitely put it on the list. I'm a little late to the game and a lot of like TV series. Like I finally finished Game of Thrones like 3 months ago.
Okay.
And I'm just starting The Crown right now. So I'm very late to the game with a lot of these shows, but I love Letterkenny. I mean, that's, you know, the funniest thing about that is that, you know, hockey players in Canada, especially when I was younger, they did act like that. So
okay, chirping and all that comes with it. Okay, yeah, that's great. So you've got some other films on your resume. You worked on Top Gun, am I not mistaken? Top Gun Maverick.
Yeah.
What was your experience with that?
Yeah, Top Gun. Yeah, that was a very, very, very fun project. I remember I got a call from Hans. You know, because I was working in another studio, and he called me to ask if I had some time to work on Top Gun. And I was like, yeah, absolutely. Came in, watched it. I was like, this is badass. I was like, this is incredible. And so yeah, they brought me in, and because you know, Tom was wanting to have you know, variations of Danger Zone, and you know, like, how could we incorporate that into the score, because it was such a hit with the original one. And you know, obviously Harold Faltmeyer's theme, like, it's epic. So yeah, I kind of came in trying to come up with a bunch of variations for Danger Zone. And yeah, I wrote a suite called Moody Zone. and yeah, I kind of appeared in various spots in the film. And yeah, I remember it was pretty hectic, because I remember Hans was in London and he was meeting with Tom, because they were over in Italy filming Mission Impossible, and we were all in LA, and so we were having all these meetings over Evercast. I just remember one meeting, Tom walks in and he's like, well, you know, our filming just got canceled in Vienna, or in Venice. I guess this COVID thing is turning out to be a big thing. And that was the start of COVID. We were working on that film when the first lockdown happened. I can't believe it, that, you know, that's when the whole start of that happens. And you know, we finished it within the first couple months. You know, I was working from home. Everyone was working from home. I brought my whole studio home. And yeah, we finished it in the first couple months of COVID. And the film was finished and didn't get released for like a year and a half because of, you know, all the COVID restrictions and everything. But That was an absolute blast. You know, I was fortunate enough to meet Lady Gaga, and she's just such an incredible person, so sweet and down to earth, just an absolutely lovely person. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. I'm just, memories are going through my head of all of that time, and because it's a loaded time, and none of the bad shit happened with the film. It all happened outside of it, but I'm just being reminded of all of those, yeah, all those unfortunate lockdowns, but necessary lockdowns, basically.
Oh, absolutely, yes, for your safety and your family's. Stay indoors. It's kind of funny because, you think of, absolutely epic or timeless themes, Michael Kamen's Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, or, John Williams' Jaws. But I don't know if you can correlate, like, if you had a year and a half to do something, because this is the most important movie ever made, or you had, like Michael Kamen, about 2 weeks to write, 90 plus minutes of music. Why don't more composers get the room and the resources and the time they need to do it? Because it's such a big, important part of the movie. Why is it the industry is like, hey, you come in late, we pay you donuts and dog shit, and you gotta deliver? Like, who signs up for that?
Yeah, it's very interesting how the industry works. A lot of times, or not a lot of time, but there are times where composers will get hired. They'll come in and have around like 6 months to finish the score. And then, whether it's artistic differences with producers or the director, their score may not be what they were hoping for. And so they would call people in like Hans and Lorne to come and save it. And they'd have 2 weeks, a month to do it, and I think that that's the thing about creativity, is that pressure, you wring out every last drop of creativity you have inside your body because you don't have time. There's no time to mess around. Like I put pro in procrastination. You give me 8 months to do something, like there'll be like 2 weeks of I fall down some YouTube 1970s WrestleMania thing or whatever, and I'm completely gone to the world. So I think that musicians and composers and a lot of creative people, it's very easy to procrastinate when you don't know what to do. And so yeah, those moments when you don't have a lot of time and you have to get everything finished, a lot of the times when I'm working on a theme, I'll spend so much time trying to make it as simplistic as I possibly can, simplistic but digestible and memorable. Because that's the thing with creating something memorable, is it has to be simple and it has to be logical. And a lot of the times, you may get lost along the way, and then it can be difficult at times to get to that very simplistic thing. But you never know like what another person can bring to this. Like one of my favorite stories about the Kanye West Yeezus album is that Rick Rubin came in and he just like muted 75% of everything, and that's what you got was Yeezus. And I know a lot of people don't like that album, but I love that album because it's simple but in a really, really good way. And so yeah, I think a lot of the times when you don't have time, well, I think what I'm trying to say is I don't know why they don't give us more time, but I can see why not having not a lot of time can create some amazing results. Another example is Hans Zimmer on Pirates of the Caribbean. He had a month to do that. And he wrote Jack Sparrow's theme. He wrote the main theme. He did all of that. He did have a bunch of composers and rangers doing the score, getting everything there. But he wrote all of those themes in like a 3 week period. Like he wrote the love theme, and then he wrote a second part to the love theme, which you didn't even hear until the second film. It's just and I've asked him. I've spent time with him. I was like, how did that happen? Like, he's like, we just had no time. And I knew that we had something great here. We had an incredibly fun, motivating film, with good direction, good acting, and it was gonna be a big hit. And he's like, I had to give it my best. I had to, get everything out of my head that I possibly could. And I, yeah, it's just you never know when inspiration's gonna hit. And I think that it has been it's happened a few times on my film that on my films, there's like 2 weeks to go. And then all of a sudden I have an idea. And then the director's like, oh, wait, that's the main theme. That's the thing. That's what it is. And then I'll spend the final 2 weeks putting it throughout the whole film. But I will say that having time, it's really nice to have that, because you can just make things so much better. And I've been working on this film on and off for about 3 years now. The film's called Yesteryear. The director, a close friend of mine, Adam, he went down to Mexico during COVID, and he was like, I'm gonna go down there and try and wait all of this out. And he wrote a script, and he was with his girlfriend, Corianka Kilcher, and they're like, let's do this, let's make this film. And he shot the whole film on his iPhone, and it really is incredible, like, what they're able to get out of it. And you know, So Corianka is, she's a part of the Diné tribe in the Navajo Nation. And we had gotten permission from the Navajo president and everything to come onto the reservation to record a tribe's healing song. And, because they wanted to incorporate it into the film. It's very catchy. It's very hooky. And so, yeah, it was kind of like 5-6 months into COVID. We went there, we did a road trip from LA out to New Mexico, and went on the reservation, and we recorded these four girls in a hogan, a prayer hut. And yeah, it turned into a big part of the score. And you know, after that, I stretched it a lot, for like a couple scenes, but like, that's how film ends. And then, you know, I spent all this time working on the film, and I had finished a score in probably around 3 months. I had to go work on a couple other things. I had to go on tour with Hans back in 2021, I believe, or 2022.
So you're part of Hans and Relive?
Adam, yeah, I was a part of that tour back then. Nice. And then, but last year, I unfortunately had to say no to that European tour, because I was working on Gran Turismo, and I knew that I couldn't do both at the same time, and that, you know, I had to work on one thing for them to get my best self and everything. But yeah, so went on tour. Adam kind of recut the whole film, re-edited everything. He came back to me and he's like, okay, so this is where we're at. And when I watched it, I was like, it's a completely new thing. It's a completely new film. Things are making sense. The story arcs are really delivering. And I was just completely re-inspired for the score. So I rewrote the whole score. In like 3 months, wrote like all new suites, but you know, that was the thing, that luxury of having time. I was able to look at it from an objective point of view, and I realized I could do better. We could do better. So yeah, and put more time into it. And then 4 months later, he was on the dub stage, and he was realizing, like, oh, we need like an intro song. So I took that healing song that we recorded in Navajo Nation, and I turned it into like a disclosure track. I turned it into this like fun, upbeat, kind of like EDM dance thing, but it's not dancey, but it just to start our film. And yeah, it was probably around a month ago, you know, he sent me the film to watch with final sound, final everything. And it was incredible. Like, I was just reliving all of these moments, the three different scores that I had written for this film. And you know, how much time we had to, develop it and turn it into what it is now. So I'm really hoping that that's going to be released pretty soon, because I had so much fun working on that score. But yeah, so I think that there are two pos there are positives to having too much time, and there's also positives to having no time. It's all about what you do with that time to make it worthwhile.
Absolutely. Let's do a follow-up once Yesteryear comes out. Love to hear more about that. But I know part of the story of Pirates of the Caribbean. I was speaking to Steve Jablonski a number of years ago, and he was walking
Oh yeah.
through remote control, and Hans was in a hallway with Jerry Bruckheimer and Gore Verbinski, and they all knew that they were in a crunch, and Jerry just goes, "You, we need you now." And Steve's like, "What's going on?" And Hans is laughing because he's like, he can't say no to that. And Gore Verbinski's like, "Who is this guy?" But that's how they mobilized and brought it all together
Yeah.
to make it. But I think it's like, well, bring up Star Wars. It's the trench run. You've got to hit, photon torpedo in the exhaust port. It doesn't matter if you have 12 years or 12 hours. It's like you hit it and then one shot that glory. So you have
Yeah.
been a fantastic guest. Your music is glorious. And I have to ask you, as a musician, as someone who probably couldn't even have dreamed that you would have gotten to the level and the achievements and the opportunities playing hockey at a young age, I imagine working at this level, being around greatness, it's probably tough to be impressed by music. That said, do you have anything in the past 5, 10 years that, like, that just shows you where the bar is. That just shows you that the top of the pyramid is a little taller. Anything that just inspires you, like, unexpectedly.
Absolutely. I mean, every year there's something new. I'm just trying to think of what, like the latest thing that I absolutely love, or the latest band I absolutely love, is Fred again. Because he's bringing passion into dance music. He's bringing, kind of like a deeper soul, a closer connection, to dance music. And I've been listening to his actual life albums kind of on repeat for the last 3 months, because it's resonating with me in such a new way that I can't believe it. Like, I'm absolutely in love with it. And I will say that music, I feel like music is progressing into something quite beautiful. And I know a lot of people may disagree, but I love how minimalistic and simplistic we are getting with songs. I love that, you can, that famous Lorde song from years ago, it was just a bass and her voice and an 808, and that was it. And I felt really bad about my musical inclination last year when I looked at the Pitchfork Top 100 at the end of the year, and I think I recognized probably like 10 bands. And I was like, okay, that's enough. I'm gonna listen to every track on this Top 100. I'm getting back in touch. Hans told me when I was 29, he's like, the one bad thing when you turn 30 is that you stop listening to new music. And I was like, yeah, bullshit. I stopped listening to new music for like 3 years. And the past few years, I've just been diving into so many incredible bands. There's this one band, I can never say, I'm really bad with pronunciation, but I think it's Anahi or something. But it's just the most out there things. I it just you know it it you have them singing like really soulful music, and then there's a really grudgy downbeat in there. And then people like FK Twigs, like what she's able to do with her production. And I there's a lot of things that I'm very, very excited about, because I listen a lot of hip-hop. I listen a lot of pop music, dance, EDM, indie music. That's where my heart and soul is from. And so I still try to listen to everything and try to appreciate everything as much as possible. But yeah, I'm sorry. I'm trying to think, because I know there's like three names in my head that I can't unfortunately articulate at this moment. But yeah, there have been a lot of people recently where I'm like, I'm excited about music. I'm excited where things are going, and I'm excited to see what comes next. Because you know, even though there's only 12 notes and only 12 notes in Western culture, people are still finding new ways of doing something different.
Well, yeah, I go to Bandcamp for my fix because there's some spectacular indie bands and up and coming. And I'm going to say Killamanziga. I'll throw a nod to Kayoko about her amazing electronic proficiency. But Andrew, I won't keep you anymore. I know you got to get back to making the beautiful music that I hold so dear to my heart. So everyone, check out Andrew's music. Follow him. Listen to him. Find where he lives. Like, he's a cool guy. We want to hang out with him again. We look forward to following up, talk about yesteryear and everything else that he's got on his plate. So until that time, we will catch you next time. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks so much, Mark.